This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And don't you dare think about changing that dial, because we're going to have a fascinating next 2 hours, and I hope that you're all going to be here with us, because we have a very, very special young woman with us. I've known Barbie for, almost a decade, since I first got involved in local activity here. Her name is Barbie Hall. She's the new person, I don't know, is it chairman, a chairwoman, or a chairperson of the local legal forum? What are you?
I'm called the president, Dr. Stan.
The president of the local legal forum. And Barbie has been back at two meetings that Phyllis has put on. In fact, she and Kathy Cummings went to a meeting back and where Phyllis spoke, and they were just so enthralled with what they heard that Barbie came back and said she was going to organize a local chapter of the Eagle Forum, and she's busy doing that. And if you're out there in the listening audience and would like to be involved with her, I can tell you that she's a great leader and somebody who loves the Lord and loves America. And so this evening, why don't you just tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself, and then we're going to talk about one of the most important books ever written. It circulated about 4 million copies back in 1964. It was called A Choice, Not an Echo. Why don't you just tell how you got really involved in the whole process of trying to get people educated about what's going on?
Well, Dr. Stan, you're not going to believe this, but I was a radical feminist Democrat in my college years. And it was the Reagan Revolution that changed me, and a father that challenged me to go beyond the surface and do some reading and do some research and find out what my liberal thinking and ideals were all about. And as I did that, as he challenged me to read, one of the books being Peter Marshall's The Light and the Glory and other books like that. I had to be faced with the fallacies of liberalism, and I had to embrace conservatism. And so that happened about 12 years ago. And then Edith Manchester, who I'm sure you are a good friend of, you know her, talked me into coming to a Lincoln Day dinner in Santa Cruz one night, and that's how I started being affiliated with the Central Committee. And I have been doing a radio show with Edith called Voice for the Voiceless for about the past 10 years. It's a pro-life local radio show. And from then on, as you said, I went, actually my cousin took me on a cruise this summer to Turkey and Greece with Phyllis Schlafly in the Eagle Forum, and I was honored to spend 12 days with this woman. I always knew who she was, and I had always admired her, but when you meet her in person, because there aren't many people like this still left in the world, Dr. Stan.
I know that. I have the greatest respect for Phyllis.
She is the real McCoy, and when she says something, you know it's been researched, and you know it's true, and you can bank, you can take it to the bank, whatever she says, and that is a rare commodity in today's world. And so I appreciate that by her, about her. And like you said, I was so impressed with Eagle Forum, and that they are an organization. When they say they're going to do something, they do it, and they get results. That I came back and decided to start a chapter, and we have about 12 members right now. And if there's anyone in the listening audience that is in Santa Cruz, I would love to have you join. If you want to join an organization that just doesn't have meetings and really get some action done, then Eagle Forum is for you.
And I would second that, certainly. Phyllis, if she takes a position, you know she's researched it. And sometimes when all the other Christian ministries are going one direction, she'll just sit on the sidelines. She may not come out in active opposition to them, but if she's sitting on the sidelines, you know that there's something wrong with their position.
You better wonder.
You sure better wonder. She's just as straight as she can be. Well, of course, back in 1964, I just converted from liberal to conservative. conservative, from a Democrat to a Republican.
Really?
Well, I suppose I'd voted Republican before that, but really only because the Democrats seemed to be so ridiculous. And then, of course, 1962, I really began to do the reading that's necessary to begin to understand what's going on. And 1964, going into the primary campaign here in California, and of course at that time, Wyatt was Nelson Rockefeller, really against Barry Goldwater. And of course, Barry Goldwater won the primary in part because of this book, A Choice Not an Echo. And there were 500,000 copies of the book actually circulated across California. And at that time, we had about 20 million people, so that meant that at least one in every half a dozen households had access to one of these books. And of course, we were hoping then that Barry Goldwater would win the presidency and we could begin to do something about our drift towards socialism and internationalism and away from the fundamentals that most Americans adhered to. And then, of course, the big propaganda campaign came about. And all of the media, both the conservative media and the liberal media. And that was the first time I realized that the same people really controlled the conservative media, they controlled the liberal media, and they all attacked Barry Goldwater. They used television, they used radio, they used magazines, they used books, they used everything imaginable. In fact, literally every major conservative publication in America opposed Barry Goldwater, and that didn't make any sense. And, of course, it's only in recent years that I've understood that we have two wings of the establishment media. We have the liberal wing and the conservative wing, but they're both controlled by the same people. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about this book, A Choice Not an Echo, why it's important, and we still do have some copies of it here.
Excellent.
And if a few copies if some of our listeners want to get them. So why don't you tell, because I know you got this book, you read it through, and that was one of the things I think that right along with everything else you had that gave you the background of the information that you're going to utilize. So why don't you tell our listeners about Phyllis Schlafly's A Choice, Not an Echo?
Well, Dr. Stan, I want to tell everyone that this book is timeless. It, like you said, it was written in 1964, but I read it a couple months ago, and I also have copies of her update. She updated this book in 1996, at the 25th Annual Eagle Council in Arlington, Virginia. And what she does is she takes the presidential elections from 1936 up to 1964, ending with Barry Goldwater in A Choice, Not an Echo, and then in the audio tape, she brings it all the way up to 1996. And the message, there is a clear-cut message in this book and the audio tape, and it's for the Republican Party. And the message that she puts forth is why we must insist on a conservative candidate. Compromise has only brought us defeat. And it actually is the inside story on how American presidents are chosen.
Why don't you tell the listeners out there how our presidents are really chosen. Now, of course, we imagine that we go to the polls in the primary and we vote for, assuming we're Republicans, we vote for a Republican candidate. Of course, you're a Democrat, you vote for a Democrat candidate, but who really picks the candidates? Do the people who vote in the primary elections pick the candidate?
Well, you might think so because America is supposed to be democracy, but what it is, it's a campaign. Just like America sells its favorite beer or toothpaste, it's nothing compared to the brainwashing. And really, it's a propaganda blitz used to ensure control of the largest cash market in the world. And what I'm talking about is the executive branch of the United States government. And like you said, Dr. Stan, most of us, because we went to American schools, think that presidents are chosen by the popular vote. Even some of us might think they're chosen by electoral college. And most of us think we will vote for a candidate who's been selected in our party's political convention by delegates who vote by their conviction. You know, they go and they think they're supporting the person best qualified to lead their party to victory. Well, like I said, this is being pushed by schools and popular media. But in reality, you and I both, that's not so. And you think, you know, when I sat down and read this, I said, well, that sounds like she's exposing the Democrats behind the scene trickery. That couldn't be happening in my party, the Republican Party. But it's not so. Since 1936 up to the 1996 election, I'm hoping I'm going to be able to get all this in tonight, the Republican presidential nominee has been selected by a small group of what Phyllis Schlafly calls secret kingmakers.
Well, how about the Democrat nominees?
Well, you know what? I was going to ask you that question tonight.
Sure,
because
I
was reading this, it didn't make sense to me why these kingmakers, these powerful opinion makers, why did they hone in on the Republican Party?
Because they already controlled the Democrat Party.
Yeah.
In other words, they pick the candidates for both sides,
right,
for the Republicans and the Democrats, and that's beautifully covered in Professor Carol Quigley's book,
yes,
called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and he tells how during the first half of the 20th century, the Morgan, House of Morgan, this
right,
powerful banking house, had people in both the Republican and the Democratic Party. They control the right, they control the left, they control the communists, they control the socialists, and they financed both wings of the political spectrum, so that it didn't matter which candidate was nominated, their candidate would always win.
Yeah, well, that's what Phyllis calls the Me Too candidate. There's really no clear choice. But you know what really bothers me is, in America, just as movie stars and our popular culture control the way Americans dress, eat, and think, a few secret kingmakers based in New York have selected every Republican nominee since 1936, with two exceptions, and that would be Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan. And these men, unbeknownst to millions of conservative Americans, Democrat and Republican, because there are conservative Democrats out there, have successfully forced their choice upon a free country. Now, I want to tell you the difference between, there are two factions in the Republican Party, as Phyllis sees it. We have the grassroots, which I guess you would call the both of us. We're the mainstream. We're actually the ones that do all the footwork in the elections. We're conservative, although, you know, many people, and I have friends who say, oh, don't give me a label. I'm not really a conservative. I just care about family. Well, they are conservative, although they don't identify with these labels. They're moral people, they're family-oriented, and they're also patriotic, and they care about our sovereignty issues. And by that, I mean to keep America within its borders. Now, on the other hand, we have what Phyllis calls the kingmakers. They are the powerful New York, Wall Street, Eastern establishment. They like to wheel and deal. They're liberals, which Phyllis says that they're liberal with other people's money. I love that. They own the multinational corporations. They're into the global economy. That's where the one world government comes from. And because of that, they support foreign aid and investments. We used to call them, maybe about 20 or 30 years ago, the country club Republicans. They believe in big government, and they support increased federal spending and control because it means more money for them. Their favorite new buzzword, and I'm sure our listeners have heard this more frequently than ever, is moderate. That is the new sacred cow of these people. And does anyone come to your mind, Dr. Stan, when I say the word moderate?
No, why, Bob Dole. That's the first figure that comes before me. But then if you look at almost every one of the current crop of people that are being suggested to run on the Republican ticket in the year 2000,
right,
they're all moderates, whether it's Steve Forbes,
right,
whether it's George Bush, the fourth or the third or whatever he is. And, of course, you go right down the line. Dan Quayle is really increasingly moderate in his outlook. Jack Kemp, of course, is increasingly conservative. William Bennett certainly would not be considered a conservative by any manner or means. He talks a good line, but of course his brother is a fellow named Bill Bennett,
right,
Clinton's lawyer.
Right.
And if you really go into Bill Bennett's background when he was the Secretary of Education, why he said one thing and he did exactly the opposite.
Right.
So, in fact, many of the problems we have today with Goals 2000 have really started during his administration.
Right. Yeah. Well, the name that I first thought of when I was listening to this tape was Christine Taw Whitman. And she is unabashedly saying she's a moderate. She doesn't care if she identifies herself with the establishment or not. I mean, that's how crazy she is. And correct me if I'm wrong, isn't she the one Republican in the last race who had the narrowest victory? Because she is so moderate. She doesn't stand for anything.
Right. Well, that's the problem. When you've got people who don't stand,
right.
you know, for anything, why they'll fall for anything too. That's the problem. Well, of course, we really have to understand that this is in both political parties. There are some good people out there
right.
who are Democrats, and the reason they're Democrats is they believe that the Democratic Party is the policy, is the party of those who oppose the robber barons, the mm-hmm. Wealthy capitalists, without realizing that at the leadership of both political parties are exactly the same people. And of course, they don't understand that the idea of a two-party system means that we have the best politicians money can buy, because at the leadership of both political parties, you have these same people. And of course, when you have a good candidate who really stands for pro-American values, mm-hmm. then he will be vilified by the media. He'll be called an anti-Semite. And how do you defend yourself against the charge of being anti-Semitic or radical or reactionary, or as happened to Pat Buchanan,
right.
He was labeled, having the mentality of and values of Huey Long.
Mm.
And of course, we equate Huey Long with Tammany Hall and everything that's bad in politics. Well, when you are attacked from all sides, and even many of the major Christian organizations mm-hmm. were pushing for Bob Dole because Pat Buchanan couldn't win,
right.
we ensured the defeat of the Republican candidate.
Well, the Christian Coalition and the National Right to Life both bought into Bob Dole very early on.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And of course, I think one of the interesting things, just as aside, if watching television now, there's somebody named Chechi,
governor.
He's being put mm-hmm. up for the governor. Where is all the money coming from?
I know.
Talk about a blitz of taking an unknown person and pushing him into the political arena. I really believe somebody probably is beginning to think about him as a potential presidential candidate. He is totally created. He has no support in the general Democratic Party. He's a totally unknown, and yet it just shows how you can sell a toothpaste,
right.
you can sell you can sell a new deodorant, or you can sell Al Checky. And I'm not saying that this would not be done by the Republicans as well, but I will tell you that he can buy television time any place he wants to. Gary Bauer wanted to support a local candidate here in California, and he wanted to simply talk about partial birth abortion. So they had a television commercial that they wanted to buy time for.
In Santa Barbara.
And it was, mm-hmm. that's the Bordenero
right.
race. And we, it showed just this baby in a crib. And then it talked about what a partial birth abortion was. And do you know, none of those television stations down there in free America would sell time. What about the right to express ideas, to buy
right.
time? Al Checky can buy all the time he wants to, but Gary Bauer can't buy time. I wonder why that is.
I know. Unfortunately, in America, we're a little too good at selling things.
Well, of course, when we have television that is controlled by people who have a political agenda
right.
and refuse to run ads because they disagree with those ads, we are in real trouble.
It's scary. No. Well, I'm here to say that Phyllis thinks the Republicans can't lose if there's a big if here, Dr. Stan. We are the party of America. We are the party of the real America because of our conservative views. If the grassroots says no to compromise and takes control, we need to have a candidate. And I firmly believe this, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to come on your show tonight, to encourage people out there. If we have a candidate who campaigns on the issues and we don't let the establishment choose a milquetoast, what Phyllis calls Me Too nominee, then we can win. We won with Reagan. we can do it again.
And, of course, it has to be a candidate who really means what he says.
Exactly.
Not just mouthing the things we want to hear. And, of course, that's true. But where are we going to find one? In other words, where are we going to find a man who really is willing to get up and express his things, his views, and then where he can get any coverage because of the control of
the media.
And I thought it was really so interesting in A Choice Not an Echo. She talked about how they created Wendell Willkie in 1940. Why don't you talk about that? Because it was really so fascinating.
Perfect.
Here was a man, a lifelong Democrat, who had no activity at all in the Republican Party. He had never been a Republican.
Right.
He suddenly re-registers Republican, and they're beginning to push him for the Republican nominee. Now, he is being pushed by the wealthiest men in the world. How are they going to get anybody even to know who Wendell Willkie is? Of course, we saw the same thing in 1976 with Jimmy Carter.
Yes.
I mean, here was an unknown
governor,
and suddenly they made him a national figure. So why don't you tell a little of that story?
Well, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. Unbelievably, he was a registered Democrat, and the kingmakers looked around for someone that that would toe their line, that they could push around and just have as a puppet person. And they saw Wendell Willkie. They re-registered him as a Republican. And then they put this man up who really didn't know the issues, which was very wonderful for the kingmakers. He didn't even campaign on the chief issue of that year, which was the commitment of American boys to fight Hitler. He didn't really campaign, period. And when Willkie finally started campaigning, voters knew. They just, like I think voters knew in 1996 with Dole. They instinctively knew his promises of peace were empty, and they came late because he was under pressure to do so. And then he had this wonderful chance to campaign against Roosevelt's violation of seeking a third term, and he didn't even mention it. He could have nailed Roosevelt to the wall. But see, the thing is the kingmakers liked Roosevelt. They liked his foreign policy, and they didn't want anyone making waves. They didn't care who won in 1940, as long as he let the status quo go and towed the line.
And, of course, would kick us into the war, because they wanted a war. And I thought it was really so interesting in Phyllis's book, as she talks about how there's this big dinner party. Now, the man who should have had the nomination was Bob Taft.
Right,
and
a
Bob
conservative.
Taft, right, he was an honest man. He was did not want to send American boys to fight overseas to bring socialism to America and internationalism and the loss of our sovereignty. That's what the Second World War was about. It was never about defeating Adolf Hitler, because he'd been bought and paid for long before by American financiers who'd given him the military wherewithal to build up his military. After all, we have to have an enemy if we're going to have a war. And so here they're having this big dinner party, and the people are there from Thomas Lamont. Now, Thomas Lamont is a senior partner in J.P. Morgan and Company. And then they have a man named Lord Lothian, and that name may not be very familiar to many of our listeners, but he, of course, was the leader of the British Roundtable, which was, he had been a contemporary of both Rhodes and Milner. He's a very young man. He had been the secretary to Lloyd George, Prime Minister Lloyd George, during the First World War, so that they could keep that war going long after logical and rational men wanted the fighting to stop. And then by 1940, he was the British ambassador to the United States, and Lord Lothian was there, of course, with this meeting of the American kingmakers, pointing out how important it was to bring America into the war so that America could, American boys could come to Europe to fight and die. And, of course, Bob Taft would not go along with that, would not compromise his principles, because he knew that our entry in the Second World War had nothing to do with protecting Jews or protecting anything else. This whole thing, at least in 1940, had we not gone into the war, there would not have been the terrible loss of Jewish life. I'm firmly convinced of that.
I agree with you. And this dinner was supported and at the home of Ogden Reed, who was the publisher of the New York Herald Tribune. And so, once again, we see the media in cahoots with these people.
Absolutely.
And because, just as you say, because Taft was a man of principle, he realized what was going on, and he spoke his true thoughts, and he left the party. And you know what? A few days later, the Herald announced its full support of Wilkie, who, of course, lost the election.
Sure. And, of course, that's what it is. If they find a man will not compromise, they will give him the treatment to defeat him. And that's one of the great tragedies of our time, is so many people want a political office that they will compromise what they know is wrong. And, of course, it goes on all the time back there in Washington, D.C. Well, then, of course, we get into the other elections. And I think that the book is really so fascinating because it just takes you from election to election to election in 1944, 1948. And do you want to just discuss any of those?
I've got it all in front of me. I can give you a little mini history lesson here.
You go ahead, because this is what we want our listeners out there listening to this program.
You're going to hear the real thing that you didn't learn in school. Well, in 44 and 48, it was called Two-Time Loser Dewey. In 44, Thomas Dewey, once again, he didn't test the best issue of that year. And I know, because when I read this, Dr. Stan, my eyes were opened, that most of our listeners probably don't know this, unless, of course, you told them. The Roosevelt administration manipulated and even encouraged the Pearl Harbor disaster.
Right.
Roosevelt's own Secretary of War was quoted, "We should maneuver the Japs into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves," close quote. And General George Marshall personally requested Dewey not to mention this information.
Now, for the listener out there who thinks that may be a little off, I went back to Yale University, where Secretary of War Stimson's diary is.
Really?
And I actually copied that, the diary, that part of it, where he actually says how we're going to maneuver the Japanese into firing the first shot. So that, you know, and there was just no question. They knew the war was coming. They knew when it was coming. And they were going to let the Japanese fire the first shot so that they could then say, those terrible Japanese, why, we've got to go to war. And, of course, it really had nothing to do with the Japanese. What they wanted was a justification to send our boys to fight and die in Europe.
And for people to make money.
Well, it was more than that. It really was this whole internationalist idea that if we had the wars, then out of the horror of this war, that the people would be willing to give up national sovereignty and go into a world government. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the war was to lead to socialism in America. We didn't have a general income tax for the general public until the Second World War.
Yes.
But we had to have that because we had to get behind our boys who were going there to fight and die. And then after the war, why, we had to have continued income taxes and higher income taxes to fund a defense establishment that was necessary because of the wicked communists. Well, nobody ever commented that we'd actually financed the communists in Russia since its very inception, and we'd financed it during the Second World War. In fact, we'd given them the material to build up post-war Russia. And, of course, now we had the ideal enemy, and with the communists as an enemy, then we had to have a powerful military. And at those days, we were spending half of the national budget on our military. Now I think it's down around 22%.
Right.
But we still, of course, have massively increased government as we've moved from a free society to a socialist society with the ultimate goal to one day merge peacefully with the Soviet Union. That's what it's really all about.
Yep.
That is their stated objective and goals. A socialist America, a socialist Russia, a socialist world.
Well, what angers me about that is that the generations, older and younger than myself, have grown up ignorant of how World War II began. And that's why I'm just so proud to know that you're on the radio, Dr. Stan, because we need to educate people. We need to open their minds, because you and I were both liberals once, and look what happened to us. So it's a doable, it's a winnable war.
Of course it is. And most liberals out there are very, very sincere, nice people.
Yes.
They've just never stopped and considered what they're really supporting. They're against a lot of the same things we are.
Right.
They don't understand that many times their very leaders are the people who are doing exactly what they oppose the most.
Well, let's jump to 1952.
All right, fine. 1952 is here, and, of course, it's a question, is will it be Eisenhower or will it be Bob Taft?
Right, and guess what happened to our friend Bob Taft again? He got edged out by Dwight D. Eisenhower.
And how did they do that? Do you remember how they did that?
Why don't you go ahead and tell us?
Well, they basically had a slogan, well, we like Taft, but he can't win.
Yeah.
And they kept repeating that over and over and over again. And then they used the Gallup polls. And the Gallup polls, which are always rigged, the way they ask the questions, suddenly show this tremendous support for Dwight Eisenhower, and we like Ike, and he's got a nice smile, and we'll never mention his mistress, and we'll never mention any of these other things. And of course, they simply bought and sold votes at the convention there, at the Republican convention in 1952, to get in Eisenhower, because he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Right.
He was an internationalist. He was dedicated to world government. And of course, initially he did a few good things. But of course, when it came to the Bricker Amendment, which would have meant that the United Nations could not be brought under the control of the United Nations because we'd signed these treaties, Eisenhower did everything he could to defeat the Bricker Amendment because he was dedicated to world government and the destruction of American national sovereignty. And that's a terrible thing to say, but it is the truth and the reality of what really happened.
Well, also, unfortunately, his campaign, do you remember the slogan of his campaign? It was called Corruption, Communism, and Korea. And once again, boy, that sounds good, but when the rubber hits the road, what did he actually do? He was also an amateur in politics, and this always makes a person the ideal favorite of the kingmakers because they can be played around with again. And as you just said, his administration, it initiated big government and it increased federal spending, and that federal spending still plagues us to this day. An example of this is his federal aid to education.
Right.
But because of his hard-hitting, sound good, sounds like he's the general, model that appealed to a conservative, patriotic electorate, he received 55% of the...
If you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to put in your 2 cents worth at 464-8295, or out across America if you're listening, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Of course, this is the time in our program when we have to remind you that we're listener-supported. And if you really are one of those Americans who knows something's wrong, but you don't know quite what to do about it, one thing you can do is help us, because we're now heard on 17 stations across America. We're being heard right this very moment on Internet. Our afternoon program on shortwave had a call from Central America, if you can believe it. And of course, we have an outreach all across America. And we can get the truth out, I think, as efficiently as most people. And because of the 35 years we've spent studying this and the thousands and thousands of books that we have available and magazines that we've been collecting for many years, libraries from all over the world, why, we actually have, I think, information that's not readily available to most people. And so you have an opportunity to help us to get the information out, and you can do that by joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. For a gift of $20 a month or more, we'll send you our 4 best tapes and whatever we've coming up with. For instance, the people who are getting their tapes this month, they're going to get a copy of a new tape we put together called The Devil's Heartbeat, which goes into the background of the fall of China, and it's a tape that we're distributing across America almost at cost, 10 tapes for $13.95, donation, postage paid anywhere in the United States. And of course, that then allows people to give these tapes away or to lend them, and gives them a means of reaching people, because we're talking about a historical event. Actually, most of the talking is not me at all. It's a Reverend Millen, who was actually in China at the time the communists took over. A fascinating, fascinating tape. And we can do these things with your help and continue expanding our ministry. And so if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to become part of our family of supporters, we'd love to hear from you. Remember again that telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV. War. Okay, we've got somebody on the line here. It's somebody named Jim. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, good evening, Dr. Stan.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, real good this evening. I had a couple points. You mentioned Al Checky.
Right.
You know, he was big in the bond market, made millions upon millions, got a big fine, And I think he's got approximately $200 million net worth now, but he's a rising star, so to speak.
Sure.
But if you check his background, it's pretty weak.
Well, the thing is that he's spending, he is being sold. In other words, he has somebody who's put together some wonderful, very, very convincing commercials. I really like him, all the little kids, and just call me Al. But he's being marketed like a cake of soap.
That's exactly it, Doctor. And I want to make a couple other points. Now, I take a lot of ideas I get from your show and other readings and call in on the so-called network talk shows like Art Bell. You've heard of that, Jerk?
Sure, go to it.
And it works. You've got to come in real nice and easy and friendly, and then you give them the uppercut, so to speak. But I wish, Dr. Stan, just a little point for you, because, see, we all don't have your vast knowledge. If you can somehow relate her, and she's great tonight, I like this history, but to the overall battle we're in now, the spiritual battle, you know what I mean?
Oh, well, we'll get around to that, don't you worry, Jim, because,
okay.
Of course, Barbie is a born-again Christian,
yeah.
and she recognizes, as do I, that this is a spiritual battle, because behind this whole scenario that's being played out at this time, there are these different worldviews. One that believes in the God of the Bible, that men can be free only if they make themselves subservient to God, and the other worldview that feels that only by repudiating God we bring about this social utopia. And we'll be getting into that. But, you know, right now we're just sort of going through the this wonderful little book. We still have a few copies of it called A Choice Not an Echo, written in 1964, and yet so much of what Phyllis said at that time is just so apropos of what's going on. And, of course, if you can get any of this information out on other stations and other programs, God bless you for doing it.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks so much. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Stan,
yes.
I'd like just to give a quote from Patrick Henry, who
sure.
was a wonderful man of God, that would maybe speak to what this gentleman just said. And Patrick Henry said, "I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know of no way of judging the future but by the past." And I'm a firm believer that we have to know our history. And if we don't know our history, we're going to be doomed to repeat it.
Absolutely.
And because the people who control the curriculum in the history books and the media out there are not telling the truth. They're revising history. It's programs like this that can educate us so that we know what's really going on.
Well, that's why I pretty feel it's such a privilege to you know, have the opportunity to be on the radio 3 hours a day. Just as an aside, we got a letter today from a young man who's in Soledad Prison. And he had an unfortunate circumstance, but he knows the Lord. He's, you know, and one of the comments he made was how much the program we do in the afternoon means to him.
Mm.
And he's actually taken some of the books he got from us, one of them, The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies,
wow.
and he circulated all the people there in his dormitory. And so they're all listening to the program
good
every
for
afternoon.
Him.
And, of course, you know, what a privilege it is to be able to minister
right.
to these people. And I think that people living in prison many times are much more open to the spiritual aspect of this and to mm-hmm. finding the Lord than the people living the good life and the materialistic life that we have. In fact, one of the great curses of modern times is the affluence of America.
That's true.
And although we all enjoy the good life, it's really created a situation for so many where so many people don't really feel that they need the Lord. And, of course, through my years as a physician, you know, most doctors are not Christians. And the doctors who did become Christians all had a personal tragedy, a personal crisis in their life. And I can just go right down the line as we would see one doctor after another doctor come to know the Lord.
Amen.
But it was basically crisis. The trouble was there weren't enough crises to touch enough of their lives. But I think that as I look at what's coming down the line, I think that's going to be remedied.
Right.
But right now, let's go ahead. Let's talk a little bit more with your scenario of this unfolding of the various elections.
Well, let me tell you about 1960. I'm going to jump to there because Richard Nixon is, even the young people know about Richard Nixon. Do you know that he was once a staunch conservative and anti-communist and even led the fight with Joe McCarthy against the communist, I can't think of Un-American activities.
Right. Well, actually, he was on one of the committees. He was, I think he was a congressman when Alger Hiss was identified
as
a member of the Communist Party.
He got right behind that. Uh-huh.
And of course, he was also a political opportunist.
Right.
And then he was a man who, a brilliant individual, but he was not a man of terribly deep convictions. In other words, he would swing whichever way he had to go to get ahead. And although I think maybe philosophically he was conservative, he would do liberal things. He would compromise principle time and time again to get ahead. And of course, that's how he ultimately came to be president in 1968.
Right.
But right now we're talking about 1960. So the election then is between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. And of course, John Kennedy's dad is buying elections. He's paid off Sam Giancano in Chicago, Mayor Daley. The mob is actually working in New Jersey come in with fraudulent elections in state after state, where they can use whatever techniques the mob would use to fix elections. And Joe Kennedy is financing all of this.
Right. And in 1960, once again, the Kingmakers knew they couldn't beat Nixon. So they decided to use that same tactic that we talked about that didn't work with Senator Bob Taft. Unfortunately, because of what you just said, it did with Nixon. And we know that the Saturday before the convention in Chicago, he went to New York, where he met for 8 hours at Rockefeller's Fifth Avenue apartment, and Nixon accepted the changes in the platform that Rockefeller demanded, and a new alliance was born, which separated Nixon from any future independence and brought about another loss for the party.
And that's right. And that was, of course, Nelson Rockefeller, and he simply sold out to international socialist interests.
And, you know, the famous Checkers TV debates with Kennedy and the Checkers spot that he ran, he never mentioned Kennedy's Senate records. He never mentioned Kennedy's sponsorship of legislation helpful to communists, namely the repeals of the loyalty oath provision in the National Defense Act, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Sure.
And also the sending of strategic materials to Iron Curtain countries. You know what? I almost got a minor in history, and I never learned any of this in college.
Don't feel bad. I had a minor in history, too, and I didn't learn it. But the way you learn it, of course, is having access to books that tell the truth, not those that are used on university campuses, at least most university campuses, where we indoctrinate rather than educate.
Well, during those famous TV debates where Kennedy looked so good, he actually said his objective was to pick up where FDR left off. Nixon had a perfect chance to tell voters where FDR actually left off, which is at Yalta. And you know what? When I read this, I said, this reminds me of Kemp's multiple chances to nail Gore in 1996, when I'm going to probably say this again because it angers me so much, where I sat with my friends and we yelled at the TV.
Don't feel bad. I was yelling at the TV, too, especially when Kemp challenged Gore on partial birth abortion. And Gore's response was, well, we're all in favor of saving the lives of the unborn children. We're just concerned about the health of the mother. And Kemp let that go by, and instead of pointing out the hypocrisy of what he was saying, that how they were using the word health to confuse the American people with life of the mother. Everybody would agree with the life of the mother, that you could certainly sacrifice the life of the child, but health is simply a word that's used to justify abortion under any circumstances on demand. And all you need to do is say, I would be nervous, my mental health is at stake. And Jack Kemp knew that. And Jack Kemp, of course, had totally compromised his principles. He was making about $2.5 million, every year or so, giving speeches. He had simply sold out, and he was in this this organization along with William Bennett and Gene Kirkpatrick. I've forgotten, there were just three or four of them.
The Heritage.
What's that?
The Heritage Foundation.
No, it was. I haven't heard much about it since then, but this troika was in there, and of course, when we wanted to get through Prop, I think it was 187, they were on the wrong side, and they were on the wrong, Kemp now is on the wrong side on every issue, but the fact he would not really challenge Al Gore in those debates, I lost all respect for him.
Well, once you read this book and listen to this audio tape, you understand why, just like you said. he compromised his principles. Someone bought him off big time. Well, of course, we know Nixon lost to JFK. Were the Kingmakers disappointed? No, they never really liked Nixon anyway. They knew that their foreign policy would continue under Kennedy. And as I explained before, the Kingmakers have had their fingers in every single pot up to 1996. Now, let's go on to, can we go on to 1994?
Sure, but, well, what about 1964?
I meant to say
94.
64.
Let's go to 64, because that really is so important.
That's the Kingmakers were trying to force Republicans to nominate our buddy, big government candidate Nelson Rockefeller. And when Nelson Rockefeller was the governor of New York, all he did is raise taxes. And he was also a Me Too candidate. And he just Me Too'd all the Democratic policies. But what is important, and this is one of the major points I want to get out tonight, is that grassroots conservatives, they knew they had a majority. And so they spoke up, and they demanded a conservative and Barry Goldwater triumph. A lot of that the triumph had to do with Phyllis Schlafly writing this book.
She sure did. And
she got the word out.
Right. In fact, we had two wonderful books at that time. We had A Choice Not an Echo, and we had a John Stormer's great book,
right.
None Dare Call It Treason. And I think it was amazing with the control of the media that Barry Goldwater got 27 million votes.
I know. It was a victory of sorts. Well, as we had already talked about earlier in the program, the Rockefeller Kingmakers helped the media to tear down our conservative candidate, and I remember this election because my parents voted for LBJ. And we know what LBJ did. He gave us an incredible increase in government spending. He increased government federal power, and he put it under this beautiful name, but it's really a lie, called the Great Society.
Call it what it really was. It was socialism. But more
right.
than that, of course, he gave us Vietnam.
Yes.
He gave us 58,000 American
dying,
right.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1968, after Goldwater's defeat, we heard this popular refrain that you and I heard in the 90s. The so-called moderates chanted, "You conservatives had your chance with Goldwater," which really is not true. "His defeat proves America doesn't want a conservative. The best you can hope for is Nixon." Well, that's what we got. And after his election, because he was not a principled man, as you said, he betrayed conservatives. And here's something else I learned, Dr. Stan. He appointed Rockefeller's main man, Henry Kissinger. And I never knew that Henry Kissinger was such a bad guy.
Oh, Henry Kissinger was an employee of Nelson Rockefeller.
I know.
In fact, basically, what most people don't realize is that when Richard Nixon ran for the governor of California and lost in 1962, then he moved to the East, and he went to work for a law firm. Now, it just so happened that that law firm was the law firm of that did all of the Rockefeller business. And then, of course, he moved into an apartment in New York City. Just happened to be immediately below the apartment of Nelson Rockefeller. Now, maybe you think that's all coincidence, that for the next 6 years, he ran for the presidency, traveling all over the country while he's getting paid a big sum of money from this law firm, and he's never practicing law. Why would a law firm pay a man who's never really practiced law, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to be a partner in their law firm when he wasn't practicing law? He was spending all of his time going around the country building up support to run for the presidency, and of course the logical answer is he had already been bought and paid for.
Right. And Henry Kissinger not only reduced our nuclear force, which I just want to talk about, not right now though, he continued the Vietnam War, and he pushed price controls, which is so anti-Republican, I can't even begin to think about it. But you know, being raised in the 70s, I was raised under all those war slogans and those anti-nuclear slogans, and I want to give our listeners a little chance to hear this from you, because why is it that, well, we know why we were told that nuclear power is bad, because that's what the liberals want us to think. But why is it so important that we do have power in defense?
why is it important to preserve our country? That
right.
The only reason you have a defense force.
That's
but
right.
The trouble is, we don't have a defense force for America. We have our troops in 100 countries throughout the world today.
Mm-hmm.
And we have troops in Macedonia, we have troops in Bosnia, we have troops in Russia in various places. We're training our military units throughout the world. We have troops all over the world. But we don't have an adequate defense for America. We don't have a defense that would bring down one possible missile if it were aimed at the United States or aimed at Washington, D.C. There is absolutely nothing that could be done. We don't even have a civilian defense program to take care of our civilians in the case of a major crisis. We do have FEMA, but that certainly is not primarily civilian defense. It is really basically a governmental agency that's set up to establish dictatorial police control over the populace in the case, in the event of a national emergency. But I really, you know, you look back to the time of the Vietnam War, and of course, many of the young people were right, but they were right for the wrong reasons.
Right.
They didn't understand the war, and of course, sometime we could talk about what Vietnam was all about. And I talk to people all the time who should know better, who think that somehow the war was fought because the munitions manufacturers were making money, or it had to do with oil, and of course, nobody ever wants to talk about the real reasons for Vietnam, what it was really all about. And of course, that's one of the most carefully kept secrets of our time.
Definitely.
But I think it was, who was it, Charles Lindbergh's dad said, you know, talking about the First World War, we don't want to, if we send American boys overseas to fight for freedom, we're going to lose freedom here in America.
Mm.
And of course, while our boys were fighting overseas in the First World War and the Second World War and Korea and Vietnam, we were moving towards an authoritarian corporate socialist state here at home.
Well, I have a quote by George Washington. I think people will be surprised to hear that he said this: if we desire to secure peace, it must be known that we are at all times ready for war. And America is definitely weak and not ready for war.
Amen to that. Well, of course, our leaders really believe we're going to have this wonderful world government,
mm-hmm.
and so
peace
we have and love. Nothing to really worry about. And what they really intend to do, and of course, if you remember the one part of Phyllis's book, she talks about this order, the State Department 7277, it was a State Department directive talking about how we were going to gradually disarm America.
Right.
And then gradually disarm all the other nations of the world. Then disarm our citizens and turn all the police and military power over to a world army, knowing full well that the United Nations Army has always, since its inception, been controlled by a member of the Communist Party.
It's foolishness. Well, the Nixon example proves that conservatives are fools, speaking of foolishness, to support a fake conservative who makes promises during an election, and then when they're actually elected, we know what happens to them. And then in 1976, because of Watergate, which we actually saw that Nixon wasn't principled, we got Gerald Ford, who was a so-called moderate again, and a favorite of the kingmakers, and... could you explain the 25th Amendment and how this was set up by Rockefeller to elect Gerald Ford without, well, he wasn't even elected to appoint Gerald Ford.
Well, I'll have to look up the 25th Amendment, but of course, Gerald Ford was actually, he was appointed vice president by Richard Nixon after they got rid of Spiro Agnew on some phony charges. And then, of course, when Nixon stepped down, Gerald Ford came in. And, of course, really what this was all about was to bring Nelson Rockefeller to the
power.
Presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did is they cooked up some phony charges against Spiro Agnew and getting a number of his people who'd been working with him when he'd been the governor, I think it was of Virginia or West Virginia, something like that. They said, "We're going to send you to jail forever unless you tell us what we want you to tell us about Spiro Agnew." So they said, "Oh, yeah, he wasn't on the take, but we'll tell you whatever you want to hear. Just don't send us to jail." And then they went to Spiro and they said, "All right, now we've got all these people willing to testify against you. And not only will you go to prison, but your wife's going to go to prison because she signed the IRS forms along with you. And so, but we'll let you off. If you just admit that you did the wrong things, you're not going to have to go to prison at all. You'll just resign from the vice presidency, and then we'll let you go." And, of course, they use the a judicial process for totally unscrupulous purposes to get, not to get rid of Spiro Agnew, but to bring Nelson Rockefeller
more
into
power.
The vice presidency, mm-hmm. so that when they got rid of Nixon, Nelson Rockefeller would become the president.
Right.
Well, of course, Richard Nixon was smart enough to see that, and he, of course, he signed his own doom when he did not appoint Nelson Rockefeller, but he realized that if he did appoint him, he'd also signing his own doom. And, of course, then when Gerald Ford became president, why, he actually brought in Nelson Rockefeller, who later wrote a book and said, I never wanted to be vice president of anything.
Well, let's jump to some good news. 1980.
All right, 1980. Okay, fine.
We had a miracle.
Wait a minute. Now we've gone through 1976. So what about 1976? You want to talk about that?
Well, because Gerald Ford was a Me Too candidate, he lost to Jimmy Carter because once again Americans didn't see any difference, so they went for the new guy.
Mm-hmm.
And we know what Jimmy Carter brought us, because I was getting my license in the 70s, and I remember standing in those long gas lines. And I don't know if you share this with me, but I think he almost ruined America.
Well, he was simply an extension of the Rockefeller complex.
Right.
He had been selected by David Rockefeller and Brzezinski to become the president. He was a small-time governor of the state of Georgia, and they created him. They put his face on the front of Time magazine and the front of U.S. News and World Report,
mm-hmm.
and the front of Newsweek magazine, exactly as they, and of course those were all good pictures. When they wanted to discredit Saddam Hussein, they put on evil-looking pictures of Saddam Hussein, and that's how you influence the public,
right.
Simply with propaganda. And of course he was invited to all the television programs, and suddenly all the commentators are saying what a brilliant man Jimmy Carter is. Well, Jimmy Carter was never a brilliant individual. Probably he was a little more honest than many. At least he wasn't cheating on his wife. I think that probably in many respects he was a Christian, but he certainly was a pretty poor testimony for Christianity,
yeah.
because he compromised, surrounded himself with members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, and he brought in then David Rockefeller's employee, Brzezinski, to become his director of foreign policy, just as Nixon had Henry Kissinger, Nelson Rockefeller's employee, as his foreign policy. And I always ask people, do you think that just happened by accident?
Right, right. And he also gave away the Panama Canal.
Right.
Which was a sad thing for Americans.
And now, then he cut back on our defenses.
Oh.
And he went along with his whole idea of beginning to build bridges to China that Nixon had actually started. And, of course, all this was a prelude to what's happening today as we build up certainly the greatest slave state in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, under Jimmy Carter, we toppled the Shah of Iran. We toppled was Rhodesia? I think Rhodesia went down when he came into office, or just before. No, I think Rhodesia actually went down when I was in South Africa. So they betrayed the people of Rhodesia. They were betraying people all throughout the world during the Carter administration, because he was simply a puppet for the Rockefeller complex, the Rockefeller Council on Foreign Relations,
right.
International Financier Complex, which has always been intent upon replacing representative government with totalitarian communist
That's
governments.
True. You got it. So now can I go to 1980?
Okay, let's do 1980.
Miracles. Conservatives united for once, and they united behind Ronald Reagan, and he won a landslide victory. Well, we know that the establishment favored George Bush, but because the conservatives were united, Bush didn't have a chance. And Reagan's conservative message hit the heart of America. It even touched my little heart. And I read this I heard this in Phyllis's audio tape, and I thought this is the key to a good campaign. And she even thinks that it is the key to future Republican victories. He called it his conservative vision of a 4-point platform, and that is, number one, personal responsibility, limited government with lower taxes, military superiority, and pro-life family values. And each one of these points had a large following And you know what? They even have a following today. We could learn something from that. And that's where we got the term Reagan Democrat. And this coalition, it produced one of the greatest Republican victories of our time. But unfortunately, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes politics going on, as usual. And when it came time to choose a running mate, the conservatives were divided over Jesse Helms and other people, and thus we were given George Bush. And Phyllis tells a story about how they wanted to have a co-presidency with Gerald Ford. And she says that Reagan stopped us from having one of those quiet coups down in South America because he put his foot down. But we were given George Bush, which I don't know if that's really a consolation prize.
No, that was not a consolation prize. That was one of his worst mistakes.
Yeah.
Because, of course, George Bush went right along and really organized everything. And I was, having been former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, a longtime member of the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. Of course, he resigned from those when he ran for office, but he was simply an extension of the Rockefeller complex. And, of course, George, tragically, Ronald Reagan surrounded himself with CFR members.
Yes.
And I think that he was forced to do that, but, of course, he began to compromise, too. Mm-hmm. And that's the great tragedy. I think he wanted to do what was right, but when the push came to shove, on occasion, he did the right thing going into Grenada. A couple of his actions really showed great courage because every single one of his advisors told him not to go into Grenada.
Right.
Every single one of his advisors cautioned him not to make several of the major pushes that he did. But the great tragedy is on some...